Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi there, and welcome back to It Happened in Hollywood. I'm your host, Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. And on this week's edition, we have the movie that shot Michelle Rodriguez from utter obscurity to Hollywood stardom. All that and more on It Happened in Hollywood. Welcome back. Well, I'm very excited to say that this week we have none other than Karin Kusama in the house. She's a very talented, versatile, and visionary filmmaker, and she got her start with this week's film, Girl Fight. It was a scrappy indie set in New York City and set in the world of not only teen girldom, but boxing rings, and that turned into a very magical combination. It ended up winning the grand prize at Sundance that year and launching Karin's career. It's a fascinating story, and I think you'll really enjoy this week's episode. So without further ado, here's Karin Kusama and Girl Fight.
I want to train with you. I want to be a boxer.
White out aerobics.
Am I talking to you?
There's plenty of things you could do better with your life than box.
Prove it.
I'll train you. If you don't sweat for me, you're out of my life.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm such a huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
Such an admirer of everything you've accomplished in your career.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for coming to It Happened in Hollywood.
Thank you.
Where we love to celebrate great filmmakers, and you are certainly one of those.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
I admire that you've really crafted your own lane. And you're a success. You are a powerhouse in Hollywood. And I really just admire that because I know how hard it is.
Thank you. I don't always feel that way. So what you're saying is completely news to me, but I appreciate that.
And you've done some fantastic films, films that have, I think, grown over the years in terms of their fan base and their appreciation. Mm-hmm. Jennifer's Body, I would definitely consider one of those. And The Invitation, I loved.
Oh, thanks.
That was such a little surprise. Like, what is going on here? And it really just chilled me to the bone.
Yep. That was the intent.
I never quite like walk around the Silver Lake Reservoir again without like looking up at those houses and
yes.
thinking of those red lanterns and everything.
Yes.
So that was amazing.
Thanks.
And then, of course, we were just talking about how Yellow Jackets, you're an executive producer on that. I believe you did the pilot and other episodes.
Yep.
What a dark, delicious, different introduction. Just an amazing TV show.
Thank you.
I think it's so original and
thank you.
And also very courageous.
Thank you.
So, okay. So I'm foisting praise upon you.
Yeah.
But well deserved. But let's get to the matter at hand, which was your breakthrough film, Girl Fight, which is having a Criterion release.
Yes.
Which is so well deserved.
Thanks.
And I got a preview of it. It looks amazing. Mm. There's amazing extras with you. So I encourage everyone listening to get out there and get it when it comes out.
Nice. I appreciate that.
I learned some beautiful biographical things about you and really how you got your start. So let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was so interesting to see you talk about moving to New York to start NYU and how little you knew about the language of film.
Yeah.
and how you have clips of your very first projects, and they're just capturing emotions on faces. And tell me about that. What was it like dipping your toe into the world of filmmaking?
Yeah, I mean, for me, what was it sounds so obvious looking back, but at the time, I don't think I understood going to film school that the purpose, at least at NYU, of the most fundamental part of the education was to push the notion of visual storytelling. The story would be transmitted through images. And so, for instance, you start at NYU's undergrad program with a photography class. And the goal is to find ways to create connections from image to image that encourage the viewer to make narrative connections. And I just feel like that was so seismic for me to learn that images themselves tell stories, and how you, what order you put them in and when you cut to or away from one of them creates an effect, and how you accompany those images with sound and music. All of that was something I just hadn't known any of the basics of. And so I started that process at NYU.
Yeah, it's such a simple concept, but it's so essential. And I imagine it's so hard if you've never done it before to really think about what all these pictures are doing and how you're going to harness those to tell your story.
Yes, and to find tension and suspense and mystery within individual images to understand the nature of blocking and framing and kind of how you make an image was something I didn't really understand until school, that was something you had to know or instinctually craft as you were making films. I mean, other people have different aesthetics and different concerns, but I've found for myself, I'm really interested in how images tell stories.
And I love the parallel to Michelle Rodriguez's character, who's also thrown into the deep end, doesn't know anything about boxing.
I want to train with you. I want to be a boxer.
Sure, it's a great workout.
No, for real. I want to fight.
Well, you can train, but you can't fight.
Why not?
You just can't. Girls don't have the same power as boys.
What about aerobics?
Am I talking to you?
Nice.
Hey, there's plenty of things you could do better with your life than box.
Yeah? Prove it.
That's so funny. I never thought of that, but you're right. That's so true.
Yes, and she's sort of just looking for those connections to figure out how to get in a ring and do something.
Yes, yes, and to find some measure of mastery. Not necessarily total mastery, but just some sense of progress, I think, is a story I return to. I'm really interested by.
So these initial photographs were kind of her hitting the speed bag, you know, just like that Karate Kid stuff, wax on, wax off, until you finally connections start to happen.
Yeah, and I think also there's something about the emotional transition that the character makes in Girl Fight, which is so much about self-acceptance on some level, you know, like I think the character is really driven by a kind of, you know, teenage ennui, but at the core, I think it's a self-loathing. And to see the character transition out of that towards something more survivable and more constructive, literally and figuratively, I realize that's part of how I wanted the audience to be seeing her. You know, as someone sort of where her energies are disparate, and then over the course of the film, you see her energies kind of distill in the ring.
It's really inspiring, you know, because she could, of course, gone into a crime or, you know, something terrible, but she wanted to do something constructive with this aggression she had.
Yes, yes.
And in that, you've made like this amazing feminist masterwork.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean, it's very much about, and this is something that when I look, it was interesting because for the Criterion release, we did a whole remastering of the picture. So I was able to improve a couple areas that I wasn't able to when it was the original film process. And, you know, I shot my first three features on film and remain very committed and romantic around shooting on film. But it was really great to have the tools to improve some areas that I couldn't have back then.
Was this even pre-Avid, the way you edited it?
It was the beginning of Avid, the very, very beginning. Uh-huh. But it was definitely no digital intermediate. No, you know, it was just you took that negative and you struck a print and you crossed your fingers. Uh-huh. And so this was a way to improve on some areas and to look at the film again in a really deep way. I was really struck by how much it's a story about a character kind of landing in their physical body and deciding to commit to being here on Earth with that corporeal self, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds so basic, but I realize that's actually a story that I keep returning to.
Especially at that age in high school where your body's changing.
Totally.
And you're discovering things, you know, so yeah. It is a story of strength. And of course, Michelle Rodriguez is so amazingly brilliant in it.
Yeah, yeah. She's got such a raw talent and you see it in her, like in her as an actor, in her as a character, in her as an athlete. It's an interesting kind of meta performance.
And one of the things that fascinates me is that you really did launch a star with this film, which you know, doesn't often happen.
Yeah.
But she went on to a career that's still very much flourishing and a very different kind of Hollywood star.
Totally. And she remains actually still quite specific. I mean, I think it's interesting. There are not a ton of people out there, but particularly women who do what she does, you know? And yeah, she's found her, I mean, you mentioned finding kind of one's own lane. I feel like she sort of found her interests and has been able to like live them as an actor. It's really cool.
And not have to change herself. Hollywood sort of gravitated to what she does.
Totally. And, you know, I remember really vividly after Sundance, she was telling me what she wanted to do, like, after getting all this attention. And she was like, you know, there's this video game I love called Resident Evil. I really want to see if there's a movie of that. And if there is, I want to be in it. And she said, I read this script that I really loved called Fast and Furious. And I think it's going to be a like global franchise that will last decades. And I was like, really? Like she called it. She
amazing.
Knew. Yeah. She actually had an incredible insight into sort of what audiences actually are attracted to, you know?
Isn't that amazing when you're born with that innate?
Totally.
Because it's not just the performance ability, it's the business ability.
Oh, totally. You know, she saw it. And I, to be honest, I didn't see it, but she did, which is kind of amazing.
Well, good for her. Mm-hmm. I've always been a fan of hers. Mm-hmm. Let's go back a bit. I loved the John Sayles aspect, which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. He joined us last season. We did a whole episode with him.
Oh, great.
And The Brother from Another Planet.
Oh, great.
Which is a film I always loved since I was a kid.
Totally.
Such a cool movie. And so tell how he got involved in the making of it.
Well, so I had been, after film school, I had been sort of just working a ton of odd jobs just to pay my rent. And finally, I was babysitting for a family who were a script supervisor and editor team who were working with John Sayles and were part of his creative collective. And, you know, they said, we love having you as a babysitter, but John Sayles might need a new assistant. Are you interested? And I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like that was, I actually felt like I learned about independent filmmaking, certainly in the American tradition, through his films as a teenager and in my early 20s. And so his movies were incredibly meaningful to me already. And the idea that I could kind of get a window into his life was incredibly exciting. So I started working for him as an assistant and got very close with him, with his partner in professional and personal life, Maggie Renzi, their producing partner, Sarah Green, who went on to produce for, you know, Terry Malick and David Mamet and all these other filmmakers. So it's like, and Jeff Nichols. So I felt like I was meeting such an incredible group of people. And it was just a deep friendship. His old assistant, Martha Griffin, became the producer of Girl Fight, along with Sarah and Maggie and John. And there was just a point at which he asked to read the script and gave incredible notes, like incredible, useful notes, feedback that actually helped make it better. And I got the script to a better place and then started sending it out. And he saw the movie come together and fall apart many times. And one day he just called me and he just said, I can't see you not make this movie another year. I'm going to commit some money to it so you can get started. And that's going to help you find the rest of the money. And he was right.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that part. Oh, yeah. How cool.
Yeah. He really, you know, I owe so much to him and to Maggie and to Sarah and to Martha, you know, this group of people who supported getting the movie made from the very beginning. So I'm very thankful.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. I mean,
yeah, it's a rare thing when people actually invest in movies they believe in. We all talk about wanting to do that. But he, I think, had already started the thing of financing his own movies. So I think he understood that that's kind of the scariest money because you're most accountable to yourself. And this was one step removed. I was most accountable to him. But still, it meant we really approached everything really thoughtfully with a lot of preparation. It was a really lucky and wonderful thing to have entered my life.
And he got a return on his investment, I assume.
He certainly did. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's no dummy.
Yeah. He was a great investor. He's very smart about it, actually.
That's really nice to hear. So, and now the movie came out of you were taking boxing classes?
That's right. So I had, after college, I lived in this crazy fifth floor tenement walk-up apartment, and I would trudge up those stairs every day. And I just was like, this is sort of pathetic that I'm like 22 years old and I'm huffing up these stairs. Like, that doesn't seem right. And I was trying to quit smoking. And a friend of mine who I met through an internship from NYU at a film company called First Run Features, one of the original indie distributors in New York. I was working for her and she was like, oh, you got to start boxing. You know, that's what you got to do because then you'll quit smoking because it's just impossible to be a boxer and smoke and you'll get into the best shape of your life. And I was like, huh, wow, okay. So I met her trainer who was a Panamanian guy named Hector Roca at Gleason's Gym in Brooklyn, right on the waterfront. I mean, it was kind of like every boxing movie trope. I was living it. And I just started training regularly and became very embedded in that world. It wasn't like I set out to make a movie about that world. It actually happened more organically in that I got really close with the trainers and some of the fighters. And I just got to know the world really well. Mm. And then I decided, what would it be like to put a young woman who comes from the same neighborhoods that most of these fighters come from, put her here. And it just became a kind of speculative exercise that imagined this young woman from the projects finding a new family in a gym. And that was sort of the birth of it.
Well, it's a great idea for a movie, obviously.
Thank you.
I was curious, did you see any women in this gym? Or?
There were women, but I even make a reference to it in the film that it was actually more professional women. You know, it was like women who wanted a really intense workout and were coming from Midtown with like their heels in their purse and their gym bags. And it was a more like niche exercise kind of approach. And some of them were really good boxers, but it was like, I was interested by the young men who came into the gym and it clearly felt like their lives were safer inside that gym and it, paradoxically inside the ring than the moment they walked out the door. Like as soon as they walked out the door, their lives visited them with a lot of unwelcome aspects, whether it was family situations or poverty or the collapse of the public education system. Like all kinds of things were making life inordinately challenging for these young guys. And I just felt like, well, where are the women? Where are the girls? They suffer the same circumstances. And I just felt like I had to sort of investigate what would it be like to give that narrative to one of those sisters or girlfriends or daughters, you know?
How cool.
Thank you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I just profiled for the magazine Gina Carano, who is basically that, but in the mixed martial arts world. And really what attracted to me, I mean, of course, there's been a lot of controversy over her social media and her lawsuit with Disney, but it was always that idea that her guts to walk into those gyms and then become a champion that really drew me to her.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of tragic what's happened because she really did make the leap to acting quite well. Uh-huh. But it's really fascinating to me, a woman in that environment and then them thriving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for many young women and women generally, we kind of walk through the world feeling sometimes literally like our body is a battleground. Our selfhood is something to fight for. Our humanity is something to fight and die for. And I think I felt that in this sort of more ephemeral, kind of generalized way. And I just wanted to put that energy into a character. And I realized I see a version of that woman everywhere in my life in New York City. Like, I saw just so many women who were radiating a sense of dissatisfaction, a sense of rage with their circumstances. And I just wanted to kind of like give a voice to that and see what was on the other side. And I hope I got closer to imagining a human being on the other side, you know, with vulnerability and with a fear of an emotional life and a distrust of emotional exposure. And I hope I was able to kind of dig into what a radical thing it is to remain vulnerable in the world when the whole world tells you you need to be scared or you need to be defensive or you need to be fighting your way through life. You know, it takes a lot more guts to say, I'm willing to also feel and, I don't know, feel deeply.
Did you always envision that she would be sparring with men in the story?
Well, I did because I always did. So like there was only one instance where I had any kind of regular sparring partner who was female, and she was actually a really fast, really strong lightweight who in the ring, but by day she was like a corporate lawyer. And she probably, I probably felt like the most regret about having taken up the sport when I was sparring with her because she did not, she never spared me. And in fact, that's like when I came home and was like, oh God, I have a black eye, you know, like that kind of moment. But I was in the ring with guys initially all the time because that was all there was to spar with. The gender component of it didn't trouble me so much. I recognize that it's, you know, for some, it really strains credibility in their mind. But when you're looking at weight classes and they're as specific as 105 pounds to 112 pounds or 112 pounds to 117, you realize it is kind of like you can kind of match people pretty well. And Michelle was an interesting actor to be working with because she had a natural athlete's physique and grace. And so by the time I felt like she was in the ring with male counterparts, I never felt like she didn't look like she knew how to box, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't just the credibility to me, but it was, I guess, the taboo of hitting a woman.
Sure. Yeah.
And that I was, you know, had to make the leap. But then, but then I was like, wow, this is really like feminist. This is like, I can go toe to toe with anyone. And really, that's the final fight with Adrian, her love interest, is sort of like sexual politics in the ring. And like there was something going on there that I'm sure many theses have been written about.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to History in the Making. New York's first gender-blind amateur boxing final. In the gold shorts, weighing in at 125 pounds.
Beat him with your jab. Keep moving to your left.
Let's welcome to the featherweight.
Force him to come to you.
Adrian approved.
I mean, you know, look, it's like, it's kind of like there were all these things that happen to in movies when you're making movies. And I certainly learned this on my first one out. Like, I wish that Santiago Douglas, who played that character of Adrian, I wish he could have been 30 pounds lighter. But there was only so much I could ask him to, like, starve himself. You know, I wish he could have been 6 inches shorter, like all of those things. Like, and so I had to kind of make a reality from something that was sort of pushing the boundaries of reality in sports. Mm-hmm. But I was hopeful that, like, there was something about this emotional, physical confrontation between these two characters that certainly for the character of Diana Guzman, the idea of physically fighting with a man or a boy that you have feelings for is very real, like that it's not meant to be outside of the realm of understanding, mm-hmm. you know, and it probably rubs some people the wrong way, but it kind of was the essential story I wanted to tell.
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating. And again, courageous, you know.
Oh, thank you.
I love the choices you make. So let's go backwards. So first of all, how did you find Michelle? How hard was it? How many actresses did you go through?
Oh, my God. We looked at hundreds of actors because I knew the character needed to be Latina. I knew she had to feel like she was 18 years old, 19 years old. Like maybe she'd been held back a year, but, you know, like she was still in her last year of high school. Mm-hmm. And so I knew how young she had to feel. And she had to have whatever actor we cast had to have enough athletic skill that even with 4 or 5 months of training built in, you could kind of legitimately believe that she became a skilled amateur boxer. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a lot of tall orders to put into one human. And
they have to act.
and they have to act. Yeah. And so ironically, we read so many wonderful actors and maybe they were just a little too old or they were a little too tiny or they were, you know, like there were so many things that made it hard. And then we met Michelle at an open call on Times Square. I remember it. And she like rollerbladed in the last 10 minutes of like a 6-hour day. It was like we saw so many people walk through.
Paint the scene for me. Is it just like people sitting in chairs and you bring
them
in?
It was just like an open like dance studio space with just, I mean, I think we literally had hundreds of people come in. And they would sit in front of us. We'd have a video camera running and we'd just chat for a few minutes. And then, you know, I would make a mental yay or nay in my head. She came in very close to last and far later than the original time zone that we had given. And this was typical of her. And we realized, okay, we really have to be mindful of time management for her in her first film. Because what we learned was she'd never acted before. She'd never really even held a job for more than 2 weeks. She was working at like a Toys R Us when we first met with her. And she just thought it seemed cool. And she saw it in maybe her like local New Jersey newspaper or something.
Okay.
And so she just showed up. And I brought her in for some auditions. And I really dismissed her. I kept dismissing her because she had no training. She kept messing up her lines. She wasn't off book. Even just the idea of auditioning made no sense for her. She kept breaking character and laughing. And then I looked and I just assumed there's no way she's going to work out. And then I looked at all the tapes and I was really struck back to this original thing about visual storytelling, how much she communicated, right, like with her face, with her physicality. There was something interesting about her even when she was sort of messing up.
Right.
And I felt like that was so, like there was a charisma involved in that I don't think you can really quantify. And so I just kept bringing her back and kind of asking her to be a little bit more prepared each time. And she kept meeting that request. And then I put her into training, and the trainers were pretty much like, she has a boxer's physique. She has a boxer's intelligence. She understands the sport, which is very difficult. You know, like, I never really understood it the way Michelle naturally did. And at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to create an environment for her where she can become an actor as she's becoming this athlete. And it worked. It meant a lot of, you know, support, and her living with our producer, Martha. It meant really kind of keeping things very ordered and scheduled for her so she could kind of stay on top of everything she needed to be doing in preparation for the role. But she just committed herself. And I think she gives a really beautiful performance.
How did her time management improve?
She definitely required a chaperone, and Martha was sort of the person who drove her to and from set and was sort of really in charge of just making sure she understood, like, the call time is real on the call sheet. You know, you can't be late. Like the most basic stuff that people in film production live by, but we just had to kind of drill that in.
This is real.
This is real. This is real. And every minute counts. And so, and she was ultimately really game for it and game for the sense of, I think, being cared for in that way, you know?
The stuff about watching her on the tape and then realizing is so fascinating to me. I have a friend who's a filmmaker, Karim Aynouz. Mm. He's going to have a film in competition at Cannes. And I once asked him, I was, how do you audition? You know, and he's like, oh, I just tape them for an hour and just talk to them, no lines. And then I look at the tape and see how they look.
Yeah.
And that was so interesting to me that it's really all about the camera and the actor. And
how they communicate and how they make eye contact or don't, and how they, you know, for me, what I thought was really interesting about looking at those tapes was I saw a thought process in Michelle. Mm-hmm. I saw her, even when she was kind of within the structure of a scene, sort of falling apart, I could see her thinking ahead to the next move. And I thought, oh, that's interesting that she's sort of so raw that she doesn't really know how it's done, but she projects so much natural charisma that you want to watch her anyway. You know, she's sort of breaking all the rules, but then you see her kind of making up her own set of rules. And that's interesting, what the story you're telling about Karim, because now when I mostly don't audition people, I just meet with them and just sit with them to see how well I can communicate with them. Because that's the number one thing, I think, in working with actors is, can you transmit an idea and have it be understood, you know? And sometimes you realize, oh, maybe I can't. There are some people that are more impenetrable or some people who I'm not going to communicate as well with. But yeah.
Is the saying that, like, no actor wants a line reading, is that like a real thing? Like, you never tell an actor how to say something?
I mean, I think that's largely pretty much true. I do think there's value, though, into talking about energy and pace and sort of the sense of, like, how is this information getting transmitted, you know? And sometimes it's worth it to just say, you throw that away. It's not, I don't want to see the character thinking so much before they say their words. You know, maybe that's not a welcome piece of direction. I don't know. But sometimes it can be effective.
You talk around the line reading to get to it.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's really interesting. And then, you know, there's so many landmark boxing films, of course, that came before it. And I'm wondering if you were trying to stay away from Rockyisms, or what were you thinking about in leading up to it?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the number one boxing movie that I watched with a lot of interest was Fat City, the John Huston film that stars a very young Jeff Bridges as a not great fighter. And I just felt like the way that film looked and the way it had a kind of casual exploration, I want to say, of Stacy Keach as like an aging boxer trainer and Susan Terrell as this kind of barfly that he meets. It all has this sense of how so much within boxing is about people who are forgotten, people who are marginalized. And it's not really about the winning and losing. It's about the sense of, like, can a person make it right to be themselves? And those were the boxing stories I was most interested by. So, for instance, even though obviously, like, Raging Bull is unquestionably a great boxing film and great American film, it is so sort of working within its own incredibly specific, groundbreaking visual language that to even reference it would feel kind of disingenuous for me. And I wanted to find something that had a little bit more naturalism, was a little more low key, because that's how I figured Girl Fight would work. If I could kind of pay attention to the imagery and the sound and all of that, but do it with not a sense of sort of announcing my arrival so much as letting the characters be front and center, if that makes sense. So movies like Fat City were really important to me. Also, this movie, The Hustler by Robert Rawson, which is a pool movie, but still had this sense of, like, how frequently the biggest adversary in a sports movie is the protagonist, him or herself. You know, that's who gets in the way the most. And so I wanted to look at those kind of movies because that's sort of how I saw the character of Diana Guzman.
Because, you know, if you read the log line of Girl Fight, I think most people would think, well, there's going to be a scene where everyone from high school is cheering her on and she knocks someone out and they carry her out on their shoulders.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, and you don't do that. Even when she wins, it's a very subtle win because the ref calls it for her. And
all this sneaking around for what? To get the shit beaten out of you, that's what.
Thanks a lot, Dad.
But you know, it was almost like entertainment.
Hey, I won tonight. You hear me? I won. What do you think about that?
I think you're ridiculous. You're nothing but a rotten street fighter. You look like a loser in there.
And then her father does, you know, still humiliates her. Yeah. She's like, you know, I won. She can't even enjoy her victory.
No, I think that's true, that it wasn't meant to follow those particular sports tropes, as satisfying as they can sometimes be. I think this was much more about, like, kind of the loneliness of this character and the isolation.
Yeah.
And how it really wasn't about getting validation from the outside world. It was about a process of validating oneself. You know, she had to be able to look in the mirror and have a kind of newfound self-respect in order to really move forward in the world.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a boxing movie that's not a cliche, which is, you know, great.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, because boxing movies are a great tradition.
Yeah.
And yet it's true that they kind of have some, like, well-worn, you know, story elements.
Yeah. Are they going to get beaten to death? And all these things that you expect to see in a boxing movie, this movie doesn't have any of them.
Oh, well, thank you.
But in a great way, you know, because it's exploring totally new territory.
Yeah.
So was it a hard shoot to do?
It was pretty hard. I mean, of course, it's so funny because when I was remastering the picture, my wonderful cinematographer, Patrick Cady, he was with me while we were, like, going through all the images and refining some sequences. And he really offhandedly mentioned how we had lost a couple days of shooting because there was something wrong with the camera. And then it was, like, over a weekend. So it took us an extra day to learn that there was something miscalibrated in the camera. And so we had to reshoot 2 days worth of material. And I just was like, what are you talking about? I have no memory of that. And he was like, Karin, it was a giant disaster. You don't remember that? And I just was like, I think I've completely just shut it out. You know, like, I remember the good things. I remember the parts where we made our days and we had the hairs on our arms stand up because we felt like we'd actually really achieved something. So it's like I have a memory of it being really challenging, but I also think of it as this like super joyous experience.
Was it hard to shoot on the streets because you shoot crowded street scenes in New York?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that's the thing. It's like we were in New York at that moment in indie film where you could kind of just hop on a subway with a camera and you could, I mean, I remember when we were in Fulton Mall in Brooklyn and we were just like, we're just going to do it. We're going to just do this a few times and have a couple of background performers that we, you know, need to be consistent, but we're just going to go with the life of the street. And first of all, I think that provides some really interesting energy, but it is interesting to think how it's just hard to do that.
Well, you have one, you know, pedestrian look into your camera and you lose your shot.
Totally. Oh, yeah. I mean,
film.
Yeah.
Expensive.
No, I mean, it was film. And so that was the other thing. Like what I forgot about was that we decided to shoot on Fuji stock, an old Fuji stock. And basically Fuji said, we will give you the last like 140,000 feet or something of this stock and process it at 16 millimeter prices if you take the whole thing off our hands. But then that's the end of the stock. And so, in fact, what it meant is we had to ration ourselves each day. And really, like, if we could get something in one or maybe two takes, we moved on. Like, so it was a really, it felt like a bit hair-raising because there was no real room for error. And yet, something about that was actually like really instructive for me to like kind of have really hardcore limitations going in.
It must be so different now on digital where you can just shoot as much as you like.
Yeah. And yet I find that like kind of sort of like the unpleasant version of flying, like more like falling.
Right.
You know, if there's not a sense of like, what's the cutoff point? What's the order to my day? I realize like a limitation is just how I learned to be creative by having that imposed on me. And so, like, to me, the idea that you can just keep running a camera is a little bit like a recipe for sort of undisciplined filmmaking.
You're really looking to capture lightning in a bottle, I guess. You know,
Yeah. I guess now that there are the tools to have a little more freedom while the camera's running, I still want to be kind of intentional about what I'm trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure people want to do that for you.
Yeah.
I would be, if I was an actor, I'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So looking at the dailies and editing, did you say, oh, I have something here. This is working.
Honestly, never.
Never.
To be really perfectly frank, it's like I was watching it for my own sense of engagement. I remember John Sayles came in and watched something close to a fine cut. And he was really, really encouraging and viscerally kind of moved and excited by the movie. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm glad somebody seems to like it. But he was like one of the first people to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then while we were mixing, I got a phone call that I remember Shari Freelo from Sundance called me and said, you've been accepted into narrative competition.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, that's great. Thank you so much. You know, I guess I'll learn more about travel. But I was so in deep with trying to finish the movie that I didn't like scream or really even understand what a big deal it was to get into Sundance at that time.
They had seen like an early cut or?
Yeah, they had seen an early cut. And then when we went to Sundance and screened it those first couple of times, I was like having a bit of an out-of-body experience just because the reaction was really, as can happen in these festival situations, but it was just wonderfully joyous and I felt like people liked the movie, you know, and that was so exciting. And I honestly, until that moment, until we really had it in front of audiences, I did not know how the movie was going to play.
I mean, I guess that's the case, you know, but you don't know because it's so personal, but
yeah,
it went gangbusters. It was huge. I remember it. And this is 2000.
Yeah.
I can't believe it's been,
I know,
24 years.
Oh, God, tell me about it.
I told my friend, oh, I'm watching Girl Fight 2020. And he's like, 2020? I was like, no, 2000. What am I saying?
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. There was a shot of the World Trade Center in it.
I know.
Of course, gives you butterflies.
I know. Yeah.
It's hard to believe the way the world changed a year later.
Oh, I know.
New York.
I know. It's so true. Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about making films is they are like, regardless in a way of even what they are or what they're about, they are a document of a moment.
Mm.
And that's something that I really held on to about Girl Fight particularly, was that it was this document of a world that really kind of fetishizes and celebrates old culture, like a past, a bygone culture. Mm. It's sort of very resistant to the idea of modernization, you know? Mm. And that's changed to some degree in boxing. But at the time, it still felt like just sort of fed on the legends and myths of this sport that, you know, has over many years fallen out of favor. You know, it's just not as popular as it used to be, you know? And so there was an interesting thing about making a movie in New York at that period about a world that was so holding on to its history, you know?
Mm. If I'm not mistaken, it tied with You Can Count on Me.
That's right, for the grand prize, yep.
Wow.
Yeah. And yeah, Kenny's movie was so different from mine, and yet I felt like we were both making these like personal first films.
Yeah, if you have to tie it, what a movie to tie with.
Yeah, totally.
Life changes radically, I would imagine, at that moment.
It did. I mean, as I recall, it's like Kenny got the screenwriting prize and I got the directing prize. And I remember feeling so proud of that because I didn't know if people could see the direction of the film, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, or care or whatever. And so there was something about like, oh, okay, to be acknowledged for that was really an honor. And my life did change. I got, you know, agents and I got, you know, sort of a door opened to me, a lot of doors. And it didn't mean that my path was necessarily going to be a guaranteed easy one. It wasn't, and it hasn't been. And yet I wouldn't trade any of it, you know? It was kind of an incredible experience to make this movie that then was so well received and that sold and got theatrical distribution and
it's the dream.
Got seen. It really is the dream. It really is the dream. I kind of like was living a fairy tale in a way.
Were you looking at, you know, the numbers about female directors and thinking, you know, I've beaten the odds or that the odds are going to be forever stacked against me? Were you thinking in those terms at all?
You know, I'm so lucky that I had been afflicted by a kind of cluelessness about the larger industry and the abysmal numbers. I was so almost maybe like purposefully had my head in the sand about that because I felt like knowing what I know now, how bad the numbers were, how bad the numbers honestly still are, I think it makes it a little bit more of a grumpy exercise to face each project and be pushing it forward.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas back then, I was really just in it, in the process and sort of in the struggle of it in a way where I couldn't even absorb the noise around how hard it was going to be for me.
Mm.
In some way, I think that was my, like, you know, if I can name any sort of strength, that might have been it, was that I was completely naive. Mm-hmm. And in a way that can be really useful because you don't move through the world waiting for disappointment. You just keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do look back at that time and try to find instructive things about it, you know?
I had Susan Seidelman on last season, and just to hear her talk about, like, there was no one else. Like,
yeah.
You know, it was like, there was no one for her to turn to and say, oh, she did it too. And
that, and I can't imagine, I mean, for me, it's so interesting that you mention her because Susan, you know, Desperately Seeking Susan, Valley Girl, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Agnes Varda's Vagabond.
Yeah, she named those
two. You know, these were the four movies that gave me a sense of belonging to something, a sense of permission to do something in that world. And I do wonder, what would it have been like without Susan Seidelman, Martha Coolidge, Amy Heckerling, Agnes Varda? You know, like, what would I have done? Mm-hmm. Maybe I would have given up more easily. I don't know. But to have seen movies by those women and loved them, like loved them in my soul,
mm-hmm.
that was transformative. And to me, it is the strongest argument to continue to fight for better statistics, more representation, broader and more diverse representation within storytelling, because it means all these interesting voices might feel that iota of permission that allows them to, you know, put their foot down and start telling their stories.
Yeah, that really just speaks to me. You know, I'm very moved by it. And
yeah,
we also had Penelope Spheeris on the show.
Oh, God,
and
yeah.
These women are just heroes to me. And like you said, the movies talk to me on a very guttural level. And
totally. Oh, my God. Decline. I mean, oh, my God. That movie was, you know, it was just like a howl from the rooftops. So
yeah,
I got to add Penelope to that list.
You know, and sometimes people say, why don't you have more female directors on the show? And I tried. I try.
I know. Yeah.
But I'm so appreciative to have the ones I do, and especially the ones that are at the very top of their game, like you.
Thank you.
So I have wanted you on the show for so long. I was so excited when this happened. Can I ask what's going on now?
Yeah, it's funny. It's like I'm in the midst of prepping a limited series for AMC that is a new installment of an anthology series they have called The Terror.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really wonderful. I'm really excited by the material, and I'm really excited by my creative collaborators on it.
Is it horror?
It is.
Awesome.
Yep, it is. I'm really excited. I have a couple of features that I'm pushing forward with Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi, who are my sort of core collaborators, particularly in the feature space. And we made three movies together, including Destroyer and The Invitation and Eon Flux. And so we have a couple movies that we're trying to get made now. And yeah, I'm trying to push a lot of boulders up a hill.
Mm.
And sometimes I get kind of like fatigued by how many of them I see roll back down,
right.
Down the hill. But I'm in a moment right now where I feel kind of okay with that, that that's just sort of part of our lot in life is to push stuff uphill that we watch roll back down.
Uh-huh. And are you based where?
I live here.
You are based in LA. When did you move to LA?
Almost 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you like it out here?
I love it. I love LA. I think it's a misunderstood city.
So much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I moved here 2001, 2 months before 9/11.
Oh, wow.
And not knowing what I was doing out here and just kind of afloat. But yeah, you know, it's funny. Sometimes I get frustrated and then I just left for 4 days and I was ready to come back.
Yeah. There's so much to love here. I mean, I think it's really important to embrace like this as a just really fascinating melting pot of a city.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this business on the side called the film and TV business. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that just happens to be my profession. But I love being here as a citizen of LA. I just love it.
Well, such an honor to have you here. Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to finally meet you and have some FaceTime with you. So thank you and keep up the great work.
Thank you. It was a great conversation.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you liked it. And definitely pick up, if you're listening, the Criterion edition of Girl Fight, a total landmark film.
Aww.
And thank you so much.
Thank you, Seth. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks again, Karin, for joining us. That was so exciting. And how great that your first film, Girl Fight, is getting a proper Criterion Collection release. That's coming May 28th. Completely remastered with great extras. I've watched them already, and they are really enlightening and exciting. So I hope that was inspiring to you, and we'll see you next time. And until then, I'll see you in Hollywood.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.